head slowly. Look at me. Would he even accept my help?
You aren't going to know unless you try it, I said, and I never said I wouldn't help him. At that, River's shoulders frowned a little more.
I curbed an instinct to edge away from him.
Then what do you want in exchange for your services? He asked.
I help the kid, I said. You meet the kid. That's the payment. That's the deal.
You do not know what you are asking, he said.
With respect, River Shoulders, this is not a negotiation. If you want my help, I just told you how to get it. He became very still at that. I got the impression that maybe people didn't often use tactics like that when they dealt with him. When he spoke, his voice was a quiet, distant rumble.
You have no right to ask this.
Yeah, I'm a wizard. I meddle. It's what we do.
Manifestly true.
He turned his head slightly away.
You do not know how much you ask.
I know that kid deserves more than you've given him.
I have seen to his protection, to his education. That is what fathers do.
Sure, I said, but you weren't ever there, and that matters. Absolute silence fell for a couple of minutes. Look, I said gently, take it from a guy who knows. Growing up without a dad is terrifying. You're the only father he's ever going to have. You can go hire Superman to look out for Erwin if you want to, and he'd still be the wrong guy, because he isn't you. River toyed with the empty bottle, rolling it across his enormous fingers like a regular guy might have done with a pencil.
Do you want me on this? I asked him. No hard feelings if you don't.
River looked up at me again and nodded slowly.
I know that if you agree to help him, you will do so.
I will pay your price. Okay, I said. Tell me about Erwin's problem.
What'd he say? Officer Dean asked.
He said the kid was at the University of Oklahoma for school, I said.
River had had a bad dream and knew the kid's life was in danger. The cop grunted.
So, Bigfoot is a psychic.
Think about it. No one ever gets a good picture of one, much less a clean shot, I said. Despite all the expeditions and TV shows and whatnot, River's people have got more going for them than being huge and strong. My guess is that they're smarter than humans, maybe a lot smarter. My guess is they know magic of some kind, too.
Jesus, Officer Dean said. You really believe all this, don't you?
I want to believe, I said. And I told you that you wouldn't. Dean grunted, then he said,
usually they're too drunk to make sense when I get a story like this.
Keep going. I got to Norman, Oklahoma, a bit before noon the next morning. It was a Wednesday, which was a blessing. In the Midwest, if you show up to a college town on a weekend, you risk running into a football game. In my experience, that resulted in universal problems with traffic, available hotel rooms, and drunken football hooligans. Or wait, soccer is the one with hooligans. Drunken American football fans are just, drunks, I guess. River had provided me with a small dossier he'd had prepared, which included a copy of his kid's class schedule. I parked my car in an open spot on the street not too far from campus and ambled on over. I got some looks. I sort of stand out in a crowd. I'm a lot closer to 7 feet tall than 6, which might be one reason why River Shoulders like to hire me. I look a lot less tiny than other humans to him. Add in the big black leather duster and the scar on my face, and I look like the kind of guy you'd want to avoid in dark alleys. The university campus was as confusing as all of them are, with buildings that had constantly evolved into and out of multiple roles over the years. They were all named after people I doubt any of the students had ever heard of or cared about, and there seemed to be no organizational logic at all at work there. It was a pretty enough campus, I supposed. Lots of red brick and brownstone buildings, lots of architectural doohickeys on many of the buildings, and a kind of quasi-classical Greek style. The ivy that was growing up many of the walls seemed a little too cultivated and obvious for my taste.
Then again, I had exactly the same amount of regard for the Ivy League as I did for the Big 12. The grass was an odd color, like maybe someone had sprayed it with a blue-green dye or something, though I had no idea what kind of delusional creep would do something so pointless. And, of course, there were students. A whole lot of kids, all of them with things to do and places to be. I could have wandered around all day, but I thought I'd save myself the headache of attempting to apply logic to a university campus and stopped a few times to ask for directions. Irwin Pounder, River Shoulders' son, had a physics course at noon, so I picked up a notebook and a couple of pens at the university bookstore and ambled on into the large classroom. It was a perfect disguise. The notebook was college-ruled. I sat near the back, where I could see both doors into the room, and waited. Bigfoot Irwin was going to stand out in the crowd almost as badly as I did. The kid was huge. River had shown me a photo that he kept in his medicine bag, carefully laminated to protect it from the elements. Irwin's mom could have been a second-string linebacker for the Bears. Helena Pounder was a formidable woman and over 6 feet tall. But her boy was a head taller than she already, and still had the awkward, too-lean look of someone who wasn't finished growing. His shoulders had come in, though, and it looked like he might have had to turn sideways to walk through doors. I waited and waited, watching both doors, until the professor arrived and the class started. Irwin never arrived. I was going to leave, but it actually turned out to be kind of interesting. The professor was a lunatic, but a really entertaining one. The guy drank liquid nitrogen right there in front of everybody and blew it out his nose in this huge jet of vapor. I applauded along with everyone else, and before I knew it, the lecture was over. I might even have learned something. Okay, maybe there were some redeeming qualities to a college education. I went to Irwin's next class, which was a freshman biology course, in another huge classroom. No Irwin. He wasn't at his 4 o'clock math class either, and I emerged from it bored and cranky. None of Irwin's other teachers held a candle to Dr. Indestructo. Time for Plan B. River's dossier said that Irwin was playing football for OU. He'd made the team as a walk-on, and River had been as proud as any father would be about the athletic prowess of his son. So I ambled on over to the Sooners' practice field where the team was warming up with a run. Even among the football players, Irwin stood out. He was half a head taller than any of them, at least my own height. He looked gangly and thin beside the fellows around him, even with the shoulder pads on, but I recognized his face. I'd last seen him when he was about 14. Though his rather homely features had changed a bit, they seemed stronger and more defined. There was no mistaking his dark, intelligent eyes. I stuck my hands in the pockets of my old leather duster and waited, watching the field. I'd found the kid, and absent any particular danger, I was in no particular hurry. There was no sense in charging into the middle of Irwin's football practice and his life and disrupting everything. I'm just not that kind of guy. Okay, well, I try not to be. Seems to keep happening, though, doesn't it? I said to myself. You show up on somebody's radar and things go DEFCON 1 a few minutes later.
I'm sorry, said a young woman's voice.
Ah, said Officer Dean, this is where the girl comes in.
Who said there was a girl?
There's always a girl.
Well, I said, yes and no.
She was blonde, about 5'6", and my logical mind told me that every inch of her was a bad idea. The rest of me, especially my hind brain, suggested that she would be an ideal mate, preferably sooner rather than later. There was nothing in particular about her that should have caused my hormones to rage. I mean, she was young and fit, and she had the body of the young and fit, and that's hardly ever unpleasant to look at. She had eyes the color of cornflowers and rosy cheeks, and she was a couple of notches above cute when it came to her face. She was wearing running shorts, and her legs were smooth and generally excellent. Some women just have it,
And no, I can't tell you what it means, because I don't get it myself. It was something mindless, something chemical. And even as my metaphorically burned fingers were telling me to walk away, the rest of me was going through that male physiological response the science guys in the Netherlands have documented recently. Not that one. Well, maybe a little. I'm talking about the response where, when a pretty girl is around, it hits the male brain like a drug and temporarily impairs his cognitive function, literally dropping the male IQ. And hey, how Freudian is it that the study was conducted in the Netherlands? This girl dropped that IQ nuke on my brain, and I was standing there staring a second later while she smiled uncertainly at me. Sorry, I asked. My mind was in the Netherlands. Her dimple deepened and her eyes sparkled. She knew all about the brain nuke. I just said that you sounded like a dangerous guy. She winked at me. It was adorable. I like those. You're into bad boys, eh? Maybe, she said, lowering her voice and drawing the word out a little, as if it was a confession. She spoke with a very faint drawl. Plus, I like meeting new people from all kinds of places, and you don't exactly strike me as a local, darling. You dig dangerous guys who are just passing through, I said. Do you ever watch those cop shows on TV? She tilted back her head and laughed. Most boys don't give me lip like that in the first few minutes of conversation. I'm not a boy, I said. She gave me a once-over with those pretty eyes, taking a heartbeat longer about it than she really needed. No, she said. No, you're not. My inner non-moron kept on stubbornly ringing alarm bells, and the rest of me slowly became aware of them. My glands thought that I'd better keep playing along. It was the only way to find out what the girl might have been interested in, right? Right. I was absolutely not continuing the conversation because I had gone soft in the head. I hope that's not a problem, I said.
I just don't see how it could be. I'm Connie.
Harry.
So what brings you to Norman, Harry?
Taking a look at a player, I said. Her eyes brightened.
Ooh, you're a scout?
Maybe, I said in the same tone she'd used earlier. Connie laughed again.
I'll bet you talk to silly college girls like me all the time.
Like you? I replied. No, not so much. Her eyes sparkled again.
You may have found my weakness. I'm the kind of girl who likes a little flattery.
And here I was thinking you liked something completely different. She covered her mouth with one hand, and her cheeks got a little pinker.
Harry, that's not how one talks to young ladies in the South.
Obviously. I mean, you look so outraged. Should I apologize?
Oh, she said, her smile widening. I just have to collect you.
Connie's eyes sparkled again, and I finally got it. Her eyes weren't twinkling. They were becoming increasingly flecked with motes of molten silver. Cutie Pie was a freaking vampire. I've worked for years on my poker face. Years. It still sucks pretty bad, but I've been working on it. So I'm sure my smile was only slightly wooden when I asked,
"Collect me?"
I might not have been hiding my realization very well, but either Connie was better at poker than me, or else she really was too absorbed in the conversation to notice.
"Collect you," she said. "When I meet someone worthwhile, I like to have dinner with them. And we'll talk and tell stories and laugh, and I'll get a picture and put it in my memory book."
I said, "Maybe you're a little young for me." She threw back her head and gave a full-throated laugh.
"Oh, Harry, I'm talking about sharing a meal. That's all, honestly. I know I'm a terrible flirt, but I didn't think you were taking me seriously."
I watched her closely as she spoke, searching for the predatory calculation that I knew had to be in there. Vampires of the White Court. "Wait," Dean said. "Vampires of the White Castle?" I sighed.
"White Court,"
Dean grunted.
"Why not just call her a vampire?"
"They come in a lot of flavors," I said.
"And this one was vanilla?"
There's no such thing as... I rubbed at the bridge of my nose.
Yes.
Dean nodded. So why not just call them vanilla vampires?
I'll bring it up at the next wizard meeting, I said.
So the vampire is where all the blood came from?
No, I sighed. This kind doesn't feed on blood.
No? What do they eat, then?
Life energy.
Huh?
I sighed again. Sex.
Finally, the story gets good. So they eat sex.
Life energy, I repeated. The sex is just how they get started.
Like sticking fangs into your neck, Dean said. Only instead of fangs, I guess they use...
Look, do you want to hear the story or not?
Dean leaned back in his chair and propped his feet up on his desk.
You kidding? This is the best one in years.
Anyway, I watched Connie closely, and I saw no evidence of anything in her that I knew had to be there. Vampires are predators who hunt the most dangerous game on the planet. They generally aren't shy about it, either. They don't really need to be. If a white court vampire wants to feed off a human, all she really has to do is crook her finger, and he comes running. There isn't any ominous music. Nobody sparkles. As far as anyone looking on is concerned, a girl winks at a boy and goes off somewhere to make out. Happens every day. They don't get all coy asking you out to dinner, and they sure as hell don't have pictures in a memory book. This was weird, and long experience has taught me that when the unexplained is bouncing around right in front of you, the smart thing is to back off and figure out what the hell is going on. In my line of work, what you don't know can kill you. But I didn't get the chance. There was a sharp whistle from a coach somewhere on the field, and football players came rumbling off it. One of them came loping toward us, put a hand on top of the 6-foot chain-link fence, and vaulted it in one easy motion. Bigfoot Irwin landed lightly, grinning, and continued directly toward Connie. She let out a girlish squeal of delight and pounced on him. He caught her. She wrapped her legs around his hips, held his face in her hands, and kissed him thoroughly. They came up for air a moment later.
"Irwin," she said. "I met someone interesting. Can I collect him?"
The kid only had eyes for Connie. Not that I could blame him, really. His voice was a basso rumble, startlingly like River Shoulders's. "I'm always in favor of dinner at the brewery." She dismounted and beamed at him.
"Good. Irwin, this is..."
The kid finally looked up at me and blinked.
"Harry?"
"Heya, Irwin," I said. "How are things?" Connie looked back and forth between us.
"You know each other?"
"He's a friend," Irwin said.
"Dinner," Connie declared. "Harry, say you'll share a meal with me."
Interesting choice of words, all things considered. I think I had an idea what had caused River's bad dream. If a vampire had attached herself to Irwin, the kid was in trouble. Given the addictive nature of Connie's attentions and the degree of control it could give her over Irwin, maybe he wasn't the only one who could be in trouble. My, how little Irwin had grown. I wondered exactly how much of his father's supernatural strength he had inherited. He looked like he could break me in half without causing a blip in his heart rate. He and Connie looked at me with hopeful smiles, and I suddenly felt like maybe I was the crazy one. Expressions like that should not inspire worry, but every instinct I had told me that something wasn't right. My smile probably got even more wooden.
"Sure,"
I said.
"Why not?"
The brewery was a lot like every other sports bar you'd find in college towns, with the possible exception that it actually was a brewery. Small and medium-sized tanks stood here and there throughout the place, with signs on each describing the kind of beer that was underway. Apparently the beer sampler was traditional. I made polite noises when I tried each, but they were unexceptional. Okay, granted, I was probably spoiled by having Max brew available back at home. It wasn't the brewery's fault that their brews were merely excellent. Max stuff was epic. It was legend. Tough to measure up to that. I kept one hand under the table near a number of tools I thought I might need, all the way through the meal and waited for the other shoe to drop. Only it never did. Connie and Irwin chattered away like any young couple, snuggled up to one another on adjacent chairs. The girl was charming, funny, and a playful flirt, but Irwin didn't seem discomfited by it. I kept my responses restrained anyway. I didn't want to find out a couple of seconds too late that the seemingly innocent banter was how Connie got her psychic hooks into me. But a couple of hours went by and nothing.
"Irwin's never told me anything about his father," Connie said.
"I don't know much," Irwin said. "He's kept his distance over the years. I've looked for him a couple of times, but I never wanted to push him."
"How mysterious," Connie said.
I nodded. For someone like him, I think the word eccentric might apply better.
"He's rich?" Connie asked.
"I feel comfortable saying that money isn't one of his concerns," I said.
"I knew it,"
Connie said and looked slyly at Irwin. "There had to be a reason. I'm only into you for your money." Instead of answering, Irwin calmly picked Connie up out of her chair, using just the muscles of his shoulders and arms, and deposited her on his lap.
"Sure you are."
Connie made a little groaning sound and bit her lower lip.
"God, I know it's not PC, but I've got to say, I am into it when you get all caveman on me, Pounder."
"I know." Irwin kissed the tip of her nose and turned to me. "So, Harry, what brings you to Norman?"
"I was passing through," I said easily. "Your dad asked me to look in on you."
"Just casually," Irwin said, his dark eyes probing. "Because he's such a casual guy."
"Something like that," I said.
"Not that I mind seeing you," Irwin said. "But in case you missed it, I'm all grown up now. I don't need a babysitter, even a cool, expensive one."
"If you did, my rates are very reasonable," Connie said.
"We'll talk," Irwin replied, sliding his arms around her waist.
The girl wasn't exactly a junior petite, but she looked tiny on Irwin's scale. She hopped up and said, "I'm going to make sure there isn't barbecue sauce on my nose, and then we'll take the picture, okay?"
"Sure," Irwin said, smiling. "Go." Once she was gone from sight, Irwin looked at me and dropped his smile.
"Okay," he said resignedly. "What does he want this time?"
There wasn't loads of time, so I didn't get all coy with the subject matter.
"He's worried about you. He thinks you may be in danger."
Irwin arched his eyebrows.
"From what?"
I just looked at him. His expression suddenly turned into a scowl, and the air around grew absolutely thick with energy that seethed for a point of discharge.
"Wait, this is about Connie?"
I couldn't answer him for a second. The air felt so close. The last time I'd felt this much latent, waiting power, I'd been standing next to my old mentor, Ebenezer McCoy, when he was gathering his strength for a spell. That pretty much answered my questions about River Shoulders' people having access to magical power. The kid was a freaking dynamo of it. I had to be careful. I didn't want to be the guy who was unlucky enough to ground out that storm cloud of waiting power. So I answered Irwin cautiously and calmly.
"I'm not sure yet, but I know for a fact that she's not exactly what she seems to be."
His nostrils flared, and I saw him make an effort to remain collected. His voice was fairly even.
"Meaning what?"
"Meaning I'm not sure yet," I said.
"So what? You're going to hang around here butting into my life?"
I held up both hands. "It isn't like that."
"It's just like that," Irwin said. "My dad spends my whole life anywhere else but here, and now he thinks he can just decide when to intrude on it."
"Irwin," I said, "I'm not here to try to make you do anything. He asked me to look in on you. I promised I would, and that's all."
He scowled for a moment, then smoothed that expression away.
"No sense in being mad at the messenger, I guess," he said.
"What do you mean about Connie?"
"She's..." I faltered there.
"You don't just sit down with a guy and tell him, 'Hey, your girlfriend is a vampire. Could you pass the ketchup?'"
I sighed.
"Look, Irwin, everybody sees the world a certain way, and we all kind of, Well, we all sort of decide together what's real and what isn't real, right?
Magic's real, Irwin said impatiently. Monsters are real. Supernatural stuff actually exists. You're a professional wizard.
I blinked at him several times.
What? He asked, and smiled gently. Don't let the brow ridge fool you. I'm not an idiot, man. You think you can walk into my life the way you have, twice, and not leave me with an itch to scratch? You made me ask questions. I went and got answers.
How?
I asked. Wasn't hard. There's an internet, and this organization called the Paranet of all the cockamamie things that got started a few years ago. Took me like 10 minutes to find it online and start reading through their message boards. I can't believe everyone in the world doesn't see this stuff. It's not like anyone is trying very hard to keep it secret.
People don't want to know the truth, I said. That makes it simple to hide.
Wow, 10 minutes? Really? Guess I'm not really an internet-y person.
Internet-y, Irwin said seriously. I guess you aren't.
I waved a hand. Irwin, you need to know this. Connie isn't...
The pretty vampire plopped herself back down into Irwin's lap and kissed his cheek.
Isn't what?
The kind of stray, I said smoothly. I was just telling Irwin how much I'd like to steal you away from him, but I figure you're the sort who doesn't play that kind of game.
True enough, she agreed cheerfully. I know where I want to sleep tonight.
Maybe it was unconscious, the way she wriggled when she said it, but Irwin's eyes got a slightly glazed look to them. I remembered being that age. A girl like Connie would have been a mind-numbing distraction to me back then, even if she hadn't been a vampire. And Irwin was clearly in love, or as close to it as he could manage through the haze of hormones surrounding him. Reasoning with him wasn't going to accomplish anything, unless I made him angry. Passion is a huge force when you're Irwin's age, and I'd taken enough beatings for one lifetime. I'd never be able to explain the danger to him. He just didn't have a frame of reference. He just didn't know. I stared at Connie for a second with my mouth open.
What?
She asked.
You don't know, I said.
Know what?
She asked. You don't know that you're...
I shook my head and said to Irwin,
she doesn't know.
Hang on, Dean said. Why is that significant?
Vampires are just like people until the first time they feed, I said.
Connie didn't know that bad things would happen when she did.
What kind of bad things?
The first time they feed, they don't really know it's coming. They have no control over it, no restraint, and whoever they feed on dies as a result.
So she was the threat that Bigfoot dreamed about.
I'm getting to it. Irwin's expression had darkened again into a glower almost exactly like River Shoulders's, and he stood up. Connie was frowning at me as she was abruptly displaced.
Don't know of what... Pounder!
We're done, Irwin said to me. His voice wasn't exactly threatening, but it was absolutely certain, and his leashed anger all but made the air crackle. Nice to see you again, Harry. Tell my dad to call or write. Or do anything but try to tell me how to live my life.
Connie blinked at him. Wait, what's wrong?
Irwin left a few 20s on the table and said, we're going.
What? What happened?
We're going, Irwin said. This time he did sound a little angry. Connie's bewilderment suddenly shifted into some flavor of outrage. She narrowed her lovely eyes and snapped,
I am not your pet, Pounder. I'm not trying to...
Irwin took a slow, deep breath and said more calmly, I'm upset. I need some space. I'll explain when I calm down, but we need to go.
She folded her arms and said, go calm down then, but I'm not going to be rude to our guest.
Irwin looked at me and said, we going to have a problem?
Wow.
The kid had learned a lot about the world since the last time I'd seen him. He recognized that I wasn't a playful puppy dog. He realized that if I'd been sent to protect him, and I thought Connie was a threat, that I might do something about it. And he just told me that if I did, he was going to object. Strenuously. No protests, no threats, just letting me know that he knew the score and was willing to do something about it if I made him. The guys who are seriously capable handled themselves like that. No problem, I said, and made it a promise. If I think something needs to be done, we'll talk first. The set of his shoulders eased, and he nodded at me. Then he turned and stalked out. People watched him go warily. Connie shook her head slowly and asked,
"What did you say?"
I said, "I think he feels like his dad is intruding on his life."
"You don't say," she shook her head.
"That's not your fault. He's usually so collected. Why is he acting like such a jerk?"
"Issues," I said, shrugging.
"Everyone has a parental issue or two."
"Still, it's beneath him to behave that way," she shook her head. "Sometimes it makes me want to slap him, but I need to get a chair to stand on."
"I don't take it personally," I assured her. "Don't worry."
"It was about me," she said quietly, "wasn't it? It's about something I don't know." I said, "It was just possible that maybe I'd made a bad call when I decided to meddle between River and his kid. It wasn't my place to shake the pillars of Irwin's life, or Connie's, for that matter. It was going to be hard enough on her to find out about her supernatural heritage. She didn't need to have the news broken to her by a stranger on top of that. You'd think that after years as a professional, I'd know enough to just take River's money, help out his kid, and call it a night."
"Maybe we should walk," I suggested.
"Sure."
We left and started walking the streets of downtown Norman. The place was alive and growing like a lot of college towns. Plenty of old buildings, some railroad tracks, lots of cracks in the asphalt and the sidewalks. The shops and restaurants had that improvised look that a business district gets when it outlives its original intended purpose and subsequent generations of enterprise take over the space. We walked in silence for several moments until Connie finally said,
"He's not an angry person. He's usually so calm, but when something finally gets to him..."
"It's hard for him," I said. "He's huge, and he's very strong, and he knows it. If he loses control of himself, someone could get hurt. He doesn't like the thought of that. So when he starts feeling angry, it makes him tense. Afraid. He's more upset about the fact that he feels so angry than about anything I said or did."
Connie looked up at me pensively for a long moment, and she said, "Most people wouldn't realize that."
I shrugged.
"What don't I know?" she asked.
I shook my head.
"I'm not sure it's my place to tell you." "But it's about me."
"Yeah." She smiled faintly.
"Then shouldn't I be the one who gets to decide?"
I thought about that one for a moment.
"Connie, you're mostly right. But some things once said can't be unsaid. Let me think about it."
She didn't answer. The silence made me uncomfortable. I tried to chat my way clear of it.
"How'd you meet Irwin?"
The question, or maybe the subject matter, seemed to relax her a little.
"In a closet, at a party. Someone spiked a punch. Neither of us had ever been drunk before," and her cheeks turned a little pink. "And he's just so damn sexy."
"A lot of people wouldn't think so," I noted. She waved a hand.
"He's not pretty, I know that. It's not about that. There's this energy in him. It's chemical, assurance, power. Not just muscles, it's who he is."
Her cheeks turned a little pink.
"It wasn't exactly love at first sight, I guess. But once the hangover cleared up, that happened too."
"So you love him?" I asked. Her smile widened, and her eyes shone the way a young woman's eyes ought to shine. She spoke with calm, simple certainty.
"He's the one."
About 20 things to say leapt to my mind. I was going to say something about how she was too young to make that kind of decision. I thought about how she hadn't been out on her own for very long, and how she had no idea where her relationship with Irwin was going to lead. I was going to tell her that only time could tell her if she and Irwin were good for one another and ready to be together to make that kind of decision. I could have said something about how she needed to stop and think, not make blanket statements about her emotions and the future. That was when I realized that everything I would have said was something I would have said to a young woman in love. not to a vampire. Not only that, but I heard something in her voice, or saw something in her face, that told me that my aged wisdom was, at least in this case, dead wrong. My instincts were telling me something that my rational brain had missed. The kids had something real. I mean, maybe it hadn't gotten off on the most pure and virtuous foot, but that wasn't anything lethal in a relationship. The way they related to one another now, there was a connection there. You could imagine saying their names as a unit, and it fit. Connie and Irwin. Maybe they had some growing to do, but what they had was real. Not that it mattered. Being in love didn't change the facts. First, that Connie was a vampire. Second, that vampires had to feed. Third, they fed upon their lovers.
"Hold on," Dean said. "You missed something."
"Eh? Girl's a vampire, right?"
"Yeah."
"So," Dean said, "she met the kid in the closet at a party. They already got it on. She done had it first time."
I frowned.
"Yeah. So how come Kid Bigfoot wasn't dead?"
I nodded.
"Exactly. It bothered me, too." The girl was in love with Irwin, and it meant she was dangerous to him. Hell, she was dangerous to almost everyone. She wasn't even entirely human. How could I possibly spring something that big on her? At the same time, how could I not? "I should have taken the gold," I muttered to myself.
"What?"
she asked. That was when the town car pulled up to the curb, a few feet ahead of us. Two men got out of the front seat. They wore expensive suits and had thick necks. One of them hadn't had his suit fitted properly. I could see the slight bulge of a sidearm in the shoulder holster. That one stood on the sidewalk and stared at me, his hands clasped in front of him. The driver went around to the rear passenger door and opened it.
"Oh," Connie said. "Marvelous. This is all I need."
"Who is that?" I asked.
"My father."
The man who got out of the back of the limo wore a pearl gray suit that made his thug's outfits look like secondhand clothing. He was slim, a bit over 6 feet tall, and his haircut probably cost him more than I made in a week. His hair was dark, with a single swath of silver at each temple, and his skin was weathered and deeply tanned. He wore rings on most of his manicured fingers, all of them sporting large stones.
"Hi, Daddy,"
Connie said, smiling. She sounded pleasant enough, but she turned herself very slightly away from the man as she spoke. A rule of thumb for reading body language is that almost no one can totally hide physical reflections of their state of mind. They can only minimize the signs of it in their posture and movements. If you mentally exaggerate and magnify their body language, it tells you something about what they're thinking. Connie clearly didn't want to talk to this man. She was ready to flee from her own father should it become necessary. It told me something about the guy. I was almost sure I wasn't going to like him. He approached the girl, smiling, and after a micro-hesitation, they exchanged a brief hug. It didn't look like something they'd practiced much. "Connie," the man said, smiling. He had the same mild drawl his daughter did. He tilted his head to one side and regarded her thoughtfully. "You went blonde. It's charming."
"Thank you, Daddy,"
Connie said. She was smiling, too. Neither one of them looked sincere to me.
"I didn't know you were in town. If you'd called, we could have made an evening of it."
"Spur-of-the-moment thing," he said easily. "I hope you don't mind."
"No, of course not."
Both of them were lying. Parental issues, indeed.
"How's that boy you'd taken up with?"
"Irving."
"Irwin,"
Connie said in a poisonously pleasant tone.
"He's great. Maybe even better than that."
He frowned at that and said, "I see. But he's not here?"
"He had homework tonight," Connie lied.
That drew a small, sly smile out of the man.
"I see.
Who's your friend?" he asked pleasantly, without actually looking at me.
"Oh," Connie said. "Harry, this is my father, Charles Barrowwill. Daddy, this is Harry Dresden."
"Hi," I said brightly.
Barrowell's eyes narrowed to sudden slits, and he took a short, hard breath as he looked at me. He then flicked his eyes left and right around him, as if looking for a good place to dive, or maybe a hostage to seize.
"What a pleasure, Mr. Dresden," he said, his voice suddenly tight. "What brings you out to Oklahoma?"
"I heard it was a nice place for perambulating," I said.
Behind Barrowell, his guards had picked up on the tension. Both of them had become very still. Barrowell was quiet for a moment, as if trying to parse some kind of meaning from my words. Heavy seconds ticked by, like the quiet before a shootout in an old western. A tumbleweed went rolling by in the street. I'm not even kidding. An actual, literal tumbleweed. Man, Oklahoma. Then Barrowell took a slow breath and said to Connie,
"Darling, I'd like to speak to you for a few moments, if you have time."
"Actually," Connie began,
"now, please,"
Barrowell said. There was something ugly under the surface of his pleasant tone.
"The car. I'll give you a ride back to the dorms."
Connie folded her arms and scowled.
"I'm entertaining someone from out of town, Daddy. I can't just leave him here."
One of the guard's hands twitched.
"Don't be difficult, Connie," Barrowell said. "I don't want to make a scene."
His eyes never left me as he spoke, and I got the message loud and clear. He was taking the girl with him, and he was willing to make things get messy if I tried to stop him.
"It's okay, Connie," I said. "I've been to Norman before. I can find my way to a hotel easily enough."
"You're sure?"
Connie asked.
"Definitely."
"Herman,"
Barrowell said. The driver opened the passenger door again and stood next to it attentively. He kept his eyes on me and one hand dangled, clearly ready to go for his gun. Connie looked back and forth between me and her father for a moment, then sighed audibly and walked over to the car. She slid in, and Herman closed the door behind her.
"I recognize you," I said pleasantly to Barrowell. "You were at the Wraith Deeps when Scavis and Malvora tried to pull off their coup. Front row, all the way on one end in the Wraith cheering section."
"You have an excellent memory," Barrowell said. "Got out in one piece, did you?"
The vampire smiled without humor.
"What are you doing with my daughter?"
"Taking a walk," I said, "talking."
"You have nothing to say to her. In the interests of peace between the court and the council, I'm willing to ignore this intrusion into my territory. Go in peace. Right now."
"You never told her, did you?" I asked. "Never told her what she was."
One of his jaw muscles twitched.
"It is not our way."
"Nah," I said. "You wait until the first time they get Twitter-pated, experiment with sex, and kill whoever it is they're with. Little harsh on the kids, isn't it?"
"Connie is not some mortal cow. She is a vampire. The initiation builds character she will need to survive and prosper.
If it was good enough for you, it's good enough for her."
"Mortal," Barrowell said. "You simply cannot understand. I am her father. It is my obligation to prepare her for her life. The initiation is something she needs."
I lifted my eyebrows.
"Holy, that's what happened, isn't it? You sent her off to school to boink some poor kid to death. Hell, I'd bet you had the punch spiked at that party. Except the kid didn't die. So now you're in town to figure out what the hell went wrong."
Barrowell's eyes darkened, and he shook his head.
"This is no business of yours. Leave."
"See, that's the thing," I said. "It is my business. My client is worried about his kid."
Barrowell narrowed his eyes again.
"Irving.
Irwin,"
I corrected him.
"Go back to Chicago, wizard," he said. "You're in my territory now."
"This isn't a smart move for you," I said. "The kid's connected. If anything bad happens to him, you're in for trouble."
"Is that a threat?" he asked.
I shook my head.
"Chuck, I've got no objection to working things out peaceably, and I've got no objection to doing it the other way. If you know my reputation, then you know what a sincere guy I am."
"Perhaps I should kill you now."
"Here, in public?" I asked. "All these witnesses?
You aren't going to do that.
No. No, even if you win, you lose. You're just hoping to scare me off. I nodded toward his goons.
Ghouls, right.
It's going to take more than two, Chuck. Hell, I like fighting ghouls. No matter what I do to them, I never feel bad about it afterward.
Barrowill missed the reference, like the monsters usually do. He looked at me, then at his Rolex.
I'll give you until midnight to leave the state. After that, you're gone, one way or another.
Hang on, I said. I'm terrified. Let me catch my breath.
Barrowill's eyes shifted color slightly from a deep green to a much paler, angrier shade of green-gold.
I react poorly to those who threaten my family's well-being, Dresden.
Yeah, you're a regular Ozzie Nelson, John Walton, Ben Cartwright.
Excuse me. Mr. Drummond, Charles, in charge? No?
What are you blabbering about?
Hell's bells, man. Don't any of you white court bozos ever watch television? I'm giving you pop reference gold here. Gold.
Barrowill stared at me with opaque reptilian eyes. Then he said simply, midnight.
He took two steps back before he turned his back on me and got into his car. His goons both gave me hard looks before they, too, got into the car and pulled away. I watched the car roll out. Despite the attitude I'd given Barrowill, I knew better than to take him lightly. Any vampire is a dangerous foe, and one of them with holdings and resources and his own personal brute squad was more so. Not only that, but from his point of view, I was messing around with his little girl's best interests. The vampires of the White Court were, to a degree, as dangerous as they were because they were partly human. They had human emotions, human motivations, human reactions. Barrowill could be as irrationally protective of his family as anyone else, except that they were also inhuman. All of those human drives were intertwined with a parasitic spirit they called a hunger, where all the power and hunger of their vampire parts came from. Take one part human faults and insecurities and add it to one part inhuman power and motivation, and what do you get? Trouble.
Barrowill? Officer Dean asked me. The oil guy? He keeps the stable of congressmen.
Yeah, probably the same guy, I said. All vampires like having money and status. It makes their lives easier.
Dean snorted. Every vampire and every non-vampire.
I said, point.
You were in a fix, he said. Tell the girl you might wreck her. Don't tell her, and you might wreck her and Kid Bigfoot both. Either way, somebody's dad has a bone to pick with you.
Pretty much.
Seems to me a smart guy would have washed his hands of the whole mess and left town.
I shrugged.
Yeah, but I was the only guy there.
Forest isn't exactly the dominant terrain in Norman, but there are a few trees here and there. The point where I'd agreed to meet with River Shoulders was in the center of the Oliver Wildlife Preserve, which was a stand of woods that had been donated to the university for research purposes. As I hiked out into the little wood, it occurred to me that meeting River Shoulders there was like rendezvousing with Jaws in a kiddie wading pool. But he'd picked a spot, so whatever floated the big guy's boat. It was dark out, and I drew my silver pentacle amulet off my neck to use for light. A whisper of will and a muttered word, and the little symbol glowed with a dim blue light that would let me walk without bumping into a tree. It took me maybe 5 minutes to get to approximately the right area, and River Shoulders' soft murmur of greeting came to me out of the dark. We sat down together on a fallen tree, and I told him what I'd learned. He sat in silence for maybe 2 minutes after I finished. Then he said, "My son has joined himself to a parasite." I felt a flash of mild outrage.
"You could think of it that way," I said.
"What other way is there?"
"That he's joined himself to a girl. The parasite just came along for the ride." River Shoulders exhaled a huge breath.
It sounded like those pneumatic machines they used to elevate cars at the repair shop.
I see. In your view, the girl is not dangerous. She is innocent.
She's both, I said. She can't help being born what she is, any more than you or I.
River's shoulders grunted.
Have your people encountered the White Court before?
He grunted again.
Because the last time I helped Irwin out, I remember being struck by the power of his aura when he was only 14. A long-term draining spell that should have killed him only left him sleepy. I eyed him.
But I don't feel anything around you.
Stands to reason your aura would be an order of magnitude greater than your kid's. That's why you've been careful never to touch me. You're keeping your power hidden from me, aren't you?
Maybe.
I snorted.
Just the kind of answer I'd expect from a wizard.
It is not something we care for outsiders to know, he said.
And we are not wizards. We see things differently than mortals. You people are dangerous.
I said and glanced up at his massive form beside mine.
Between the two of us, I'm the dangerous one.
Like a child waving around his father's gun, River's shoulders said.
Something in his voice became gentler.
Though some of you are better than others about it, I admit.
My point is, I said, the kid's got a life force like few I've seen. When Connie's hunger awakened, she fed on him without any kind of restraint, and he wound up with nothing worse than a hangover. Could be that he could handle a life with her just fine.
River's shoulders nodded slowly. His expression might have been thoughtful. It was too dark, and his features too blunt and chiseled, to be sure.
The girl seems genuinely fond of him, and he of her. I mean, I'm not an expert in these things, but they seem to like each other. And even when they have a difference of opinions, they fight fair. That's a good sign. I squinted at him. Do you really think he's in danger?
Yes, River's shoulder said. They have to kill him now.
I blinked. What?
This creature, this Beruil.
Yeah?
It sent its child to this place with the intention that she meet a young man and feed upon him and unknowingly kill him.
Yeah? River's shoulder shook his huge head sadly.
What kind of monster does that to its children?
Vampires, I said. It isn't uncommon, from what I hear.
Because they hurt, River's shoulder said. Beruil remembers his own first lover. He remembers being with her. He remembers her death. And his Wendigo has had its hand on his heart ever since. It shaped his life.
Wendigo?
River's shoulders waved a hand. General term, spirit of hunger, can't ever be sated.
Ah, gotcha.
Now, Beruil. He had his father tell him that this was how it had to be. That it had to be that way to make him a good vampire. So this thing that turned him into a murdering monster is actually a good thing. He spends his whole life trying to convince himself of that.
River nodded slowly.
What happens when his child does something differently?
I felt like a moron.
It means that what his father told him was a lie. It means that maybe he didn't have to be like he is. It means that he's been lying to himself about everything.
River's shoulders spread his hands, palm up, as if presenting the fact.
That kind of father has to make his children in his own image. He has to make the lie true.
He has to make sure Connie kills Irwin, I said. We've got to get him out of there, maybe both of them.
How? River's shoulders said. She doesn't know. He only knows a little. Neither knows enough to be wise enough to run.
They shouldn't have to run, I growled.
Avoiding a fight is always better than not avoiding one.
Disagree, I said. Some fights should be sought out and fought and won.
River's shoulders shook his head.
Your father's gun.
I sensed a deep current of resistance in River's shoulders on this subject. One that I would never be able to bridge, I suspected. River just wasn't a fighter.
Would you agree it was wisest if they both fled?
In this case, it might, yeah. But I think it would only delay the confrontation. Guys like Barrow will have long arms. If he obsesses over it, he'll find them sooner or later.
I have no right to take his child from him, River Shoulders said. I'm only interested in Erwin.
Well, I'm not going to be able to separate them, I said. Erwin nearly started swinging at me when I went anywhere close to that subject. I paused and added, but he might listen to you.
River Shoulders shook his head. He's right. I got no right to walk in and smash his life to splinters after being so far away so long. He'd never listen to me. He's got a lot of anger in him, maybe for good reasons.
You're his father, I said. That might carry more weight than you think.
I should not have involved you in this, he said. I apologize for that, wizard. You should go. Let me sort this out on my own.
I eyed River Shoulders. The big guy was powerful, sure, but he was also slow. He took his time making decisions. He played things out with enormous patience. He was clearly ambivalent over what kind of involvement he should have with his son. It might take him months of observation and cogitation to make a choice. Most of us don't live that way. I was sure Barrowill didn't. If the vampire was moving, he might be moving now, like right now.
In this particular instance, River Shoulders, you are not thinking clearly, I said. Action must be taken soon, preferably tonight.
I will be what I am, River said firmly. I stood up from the log and nodded.
Okay, I said.
Me too.
I put in a call to my fellow warden, Wild Bill Myers, in Dallas, but got an answering service. I left a message that I was in Norman and needed his help, but I had little faith that he'd show up in time. The real downside to being a wizard is that we void the warranties of anything technological every time we sneeze. Cell phones are worse than useless in our hands, and it makes communications a challenge at times, though that was far from the only possible obstacle. If Bill was in, he'd have picked up his phone. He had a big area for his beat and likely had problems of his own. But since Dallas was only 3 hours away, assuming his car didn't break down, I could hold out hope that he might roll in by morning. So I got in my busted-up old Volkswagen, picked up a prop, and drove up to the campus alone. I parked somewhere where I would probably get a ticket. I planned to ignore it. Anarchists have a much easier time finding parking spots. I got out and walked toward one of the smaller dorm buildings on campus. I didn't have my wizard's staff with me, on account of how weird it looked to walk around with one, but my blasting rod was hanging from its tie inside my leather duster. I doubted I would need it, but better to have it and not need it than the other way around. I got my prop and trudged across a short bit of turquoise-tinted grass to the honors dorms where Erwin lived. They were tiny for that campus, maybe 5 stories, with the building laid out in 4 right-angled halls like a plus sign. The door was locked. There's always that kind of security in a dorm building these days. I rapped on the glass with my knuckles until a passing student noticed. I held up a cardboard box from the local Pizza Express and tried to look like I needed a break. I needn't have tried so hard. The kid's eyes were bloodshot and glassy. He was baked on something. He opened the door for me without blinking.
Thanks.
No problem, he said.
He was supposed to meet me at the doors, I said. You see a guy named, I checked the receipt that was taped to the box.
Erwin Pounder?
Pounder, the kid said. He'll be in his room, 4th floor, south hall, 3rd door on the left. Just listen for the noise.
Music?
He tittered.
Not exactly.
I thanked him and ambled up the stairs, which were getting to be a lot harder on my knees than they used to be. Maybe I needed orthopedic shoes or something. I got to the 2nd floor before I felt it. There was a tension in the air, something that made my heart speed up and my skin feel hot. A few steps later, I started breathing faster and louder. It wasn't until I got to the 3rd floor that I remembered that the most dangerous aspect of a psychic assault
is that the victim almost never realizes that it's actually happening. I stopped and threw up my mental defenses in a sudden panic, and the surge of adrenaline and fear suddenly overcame the tremors of restless need that I'd been feeling.